Coming up right now, Animal Voices. Those were lions complaining about life in general, I think. Good afternoon and welcome to Animal Voices. Thanks for tuning in. This is Co-op Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver, and we've got a great show for you today. Our first guest is going to be Virginia Phillips, and she's a holistic healer, and she is a healer of birds. After that, we're going to be talking to a lawyer, Dan Kilborn, who's with Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine based in Washington, D.C., and they've lodged a lawsuit against Merck Pharmaceuticals with respect to their drug Vioxx, which has just recently been taken off the market for killing people. And another thing that kills people, of course, is meth. And it's been in the news lately, as I believe there are about 34 casualties every year from this drug. Well, that doesn't really compare to the number of people who are killed by pharmaceutical drugs in Canada, which amounts to some 10 to 20,000 people every year. And it seems that once you don a white coat, murder becomes acceptable. I don't know what it is about that, but there's something mesmerizing about these gentlemen in the white coats that that blinds everyone, it seems. Well, we have a very fine commentary by Croft Woodruff, who's an activist here in town, who also has a radio show, by the way, and that you should tune into. It's 1 o'clock every Wednesday afternoon here on CFRO. It's called Dynamic Health. And he's written a letter to the Minister of Justice, Minister Kotler. And he writes, when the government announced increased sentences, including life sentences, for those caught pushing crystal meth, does this mean all pushers and users of crystal meth amphetamine? What about military personnel who use it to counteract fatigue, elevate mood, and heighten endurance? Are you aware the two American pilots who killed our soldiers in Afghanistan were on amphetamines, as are all U.S. combat personnel? What about U.S. military personnel who are based in Canada or have come to visit Canada? Since the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency appears now to have jurisdiction over Canadians who have broken no Canadian law selling marijuana seeds, which incidentally contain no THC, and when shelled are an excellent food source, will you extradite those American pilots to face Canadian justice for amphetamine use that contributed to, if not directly caused, the death of innocent Canadian military personnel, or require U.S. military to test for amphetamines who are in or visiting Canada? With all the media and government hoo-ha about crystal meth, why doesn't anyone connect the use of Ritalin, which is methylphenidate, dextrodrine, methamphetamine, and dextroamphetamine on hyperactive children that may condition them to use crystal meth as adults? Ritalin is almost identical to cocaine and amphetamines. Researchers at Brookhaven National Laboratory in Upton, New York, found that when Ritalin was injected into healthy test subjects, it had the same pattern of distribution in the brain as cocaine. In fact, when Ritalin was given to cocaine users, they couldn't distinguish the Ritalin high from a cocaine high. Physicians, psychiatrists, psychologists, and teachers who advocate the use of Ritalin as an easy way out to deal with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder are unwittingly turning these children into future addicts. Does anyone in government know how many of these children continue on to adulthood conditioned to use amphetamines? The real issue is the failure of modern medicine and psychiatry and Health Canada to recognize that these children are victims of chemical hypersensitivity that triggers allergy reactions to certain foods, food additives such as artificial colors, flavors, pesticides, herbicides, and other toxins and heavy metals such as lead, arsenic, and mercury, and ultimately the failure of government to limit contamination of the environment and the food chain are really to blame. Does government honestly believe it's going to solve what is essentially a health or environmental and social political problem by creating more jails? On a per capita basis, the United States has more people in jail than any other country in the world, including dictatorships such as China and the successor states of the former Soviet Union. Has the government not learned that our neighbor to the south has lost the war on drugs? That was Croft Woodruff, and he has a little shop on Fraser Street, and you can visit him there at 6417 Fraser Street. His phone number is 324-2121. He's a great, he's a master herbalist and a great consultant for any health questions that you may have. Now, I'm going to turn it over to Marge and an interview with Virginia Phillips on the healing of birds.
Thank you, John. Yes, the studio guest today is Virginia Phillips, who is a healing facilitator. Virginia uses a holistic approach to healing, which includes homeopathic and naturopathic medicines. Methods. Ms. Phillips primarily treats birds, but when necessary, she will also treat other species. She's a Reiki master, which is an ancient Japanese energy healing method, and has studied under a Zen master. Virginia Phillips has been healing birds for the last 10 years. Welcome to Animal Voices, Virginia.
Thank you very much, Marge. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. You have a very extensive background in healing. I know you're starting with humans and working your way up to birds.
Yes, that's right.
And how did you become aware of your ability to heal birds?
Well, about 10 years ago, a little budgie was dropped at my doorstep, basically. And the man said, I don't want this bird anymore. It doesn't bond with me and it doesn't do anything. So I took it in and I'd never had a bird before. But as the days passed, actually very few days had to pass before I realized I had an affinity with birds. And it was different to anything I'd ever had before. It was a different feeling. And I seemed to be able to talk to this little bird, and the little bird told me what it wanted to have, and it worked. Anyway, I had heard later that budgies love budgies, so I got a little female for this boy. And nothing happened there, by the way. But then I got two more, and then I got two more, and then I got two more, and so it went on. And now I have graduated to larger birds as well. So I have them all in my one-bedroom apartment. And I also board birds and take them in for different healing purposes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How do they communicate? You talked about knowing what the bird wanted and so on. How does that communication take place?
It's very difficult to really explain how it does, but I think if you align yourself with the sort of source that we all are, and you begin to think, almost feel like a bird, or feel like if it was a dog, but in my case, it's feel like a bird. And also get into the cage in your mind or wherever the bird is and see it from a bird's eye view where it would like to go and where it would like to eat and how near this dish should be to that perch. And if it's a handicapped bird and can't reach, it's very frustrating. And it has no real way of telling you.
But you have that sensitivity to the bird.
Yes,
it's
exactly.
Wonderful.
Exactly.
What type of problems do you treat?
I would treat anything from behavioral problems, aggression, fear mostly. Most birds, whatever the behavior, usually comes from some sort of fear, I think, with everything. I have treated tumors for budgies. I have treated liver disease when nothing else could be done by the vet. Because I must say, first of all, medicine is the important thing. The veterinary care is important. So So that's the first thing. I take over from that.
So the bird would first be taken to the veterinarian if it has a medical problem or what appears to be a medical problem, and then the veterinarian probably refers to you.
After when there's, yes, nothing else that can be done, or whether it's something that may be going to be a chronic thing, it's going to go on for a long time, then I would possibly take over, yes.
Now, you have a fairly large number of birds in your home. You have
yes.
seven, I believe, right now,
yes,
of your own,
right.
don't you? And then you?
Seven of my own.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And then you take in boarders,
mm-hmm.
and you also have birds in for healing.
That's right.
How do you manage all these different creatures in your home?
With difficulty sometimes. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of them. But the basic thing for anything like that is to calm yourself down first, because a flustered person running around with dishes and water and cleaning is not going to help any bird or any environment. So basically, it is to take a few deep breaths if you need to yourself and act calm, and then you will be calm. That's, I think, the key for my own manageability with birds in my own home.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. How are they housed?
They're housed in cages first, but I allow pretty well all of them to come out of their cages all day long until they have to go to bed, except when I go to work.
Oh, and then they're in their cages?
Then they're in their cages. It's just uh-huh. safety. It has to be. Mm-hmm. You know.
But they do get along well, you said earlier.
They do. Even when people say that this bird won't get on with any, I find that after a day or two, they do. They really do. Yes.
Uh-huh. And your birds are not jealous of them?
No, one has been at one point, and it just takes a little understanding that I love you very much. It happens to be Bijou, a little Myers parrot. And you're my number one bird, but I do that so that nobody else can hear. And then take them into another room and give them lots of cuddles. And mm-hmm. they know I love them. So I love them all. And it's like a mother with lots of children, I suppose. When you love them equally, they know.
Uh-huh. And introducing a new bird, would that bird stay in the cage for a little while to become comfortable, or how do you introduce a new one?
Yes, introducing a new bird, definitely for the first 2 hours the bird would be in the cage. Then, depending on the way he's acting, he could come out of the cage. Of course, if it's a canary or a finch, they never come out. They have to stay in. It's too dangerous. Finches and canaries don't fly around with other birds. It's just one of those things you don't do.
Would they attack mm-hmm. other birds, or other birds attack
other
them?
Other birds would attack them or eat them. Or they also are very scared. They would be frightened of this environment, and they'd bang into walls perhaps, or try and fly out of the window, although it's secured. But mm-hmm. they could injure themselves. It's just not a thing you do.
You must mm-hmm. have to do a lot of cleaning around your house with these free
non-stop
free-flying birds.
Yes, it is non-stop cleaning. Yes, uh-huh. absolutely. And that's the thing you do when you have birds out, because they will throw their food, especially if it's red, like raspberries and strawberries. That's when they really like to throw their food. They seem to know that, you know, a nice painted wall, white wall with red blotches is rather nice.
Now, I know that you also work at the Night Owl Bird Hospital in
yes,
Vancouver.
I do.
And maybe you could tell us a little bit about your work with birds there, could you?
Well, I'm basically a receptionist there, a part-time receptionist. But Dr. McDonald very kindly lets me heal birds or cold them, and especially palliative birds, palliative care birds, from about 7 o'clock to 8 in the evening. So I have, she tells me which birds are the sickest, and then if they can be held, I held them. And if they can't, then I will do Reiki or some other healing with my hands at either side of their unit and talk to them. They can hear me. Mm-hmm. There are holes where they can hear me. They can
this
see
relaxes
me.
The bird, I guess, does it?
It certainly does, yes. Uh-huh. It's a very busy place. And you know, sometimes they need a bit of calming down, but they do, and they do all that at the hospital. I mean, they're wonderful.
Yes, and I guess while in hospital, the birds are in individual cages, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. They don't come out at all in the hospital. They can't. There are too many birds and too many sick birds.
Right.
You know.
So your aim really is to make the bird comfortable, I guess, when it's on palliative care.
Absolutely, yes. And to give it some help in transition if it is dying. I was trained on that when I was doing Zen Buddhism, and I rather modified it to my own what word would I use? Stuff, really. My own way of letting a bird pass and also helping the owner when it's going through grief.
I should think that would be an important part of
yes,
the care, wouldn't it?
Grief counseling is one of the things I did do beforehand. And so it's well integrated into this.
I know veterinary care is expensive at any time, but I should think
yes.
when it requires a specialist, it's even more expensive. I wonder if people sometimes will come to you and hope that you can solve the problem, whatever it happens to be.
Sometimes they do. If it's a medical problem, I would always ask if they would go to the veterinarian first, because then it can be really sorted out, because I cannot be responsible for a simple physical problem that could be cured at a hospital. So I do not override any medical care, but I can complement it. It's complementary holistic medicine, which can go hand in hand with the medical care. And then when the medical care is finished, or even in between, I can do my holistic healing.
I see.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're also a member of a Greyhaven Exotic Bird Sanctuary in
yes.
Surrey. Now,
mm-hmm.
they do some good work. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that, could you?
Oh, they do excellent work. It is, again, a voluntary organization where they have a lot of volunteers helping to house and care for birds who have been rescued or who have been abandoned or who are very old. And it's a constant, it's a difficult job because they are constantly, it's not that they're overcrowded, but they haven't got enough land and they need, you know, with this sort of thing, you always need more things, you know, even if it's ladders and pails and buckets and cages, you know, everything is welcome at that
oh,
place.
I see. They've put donations of all
oh,
kinds.
Oh, it's all, yes,
yeah.
yes.
Uh-huh.
They have a very good system, but it's never... You know, it's never enough, as you know, with that sort of thing.
I should think, like other exotic pets, birds are abandoned by their owners and probably others rescue them and take them to the sanctuary.
That's right. That's absolutely right.
Yeah,
yes.
It's a shame because these exotics are not that easy to care for, and people make big mistakes, don't they?
Well, they see a beautiful bird or a little bird and want it as a pet, and they don't realize that this bird is either a baby and could develop any behavioral problems or physical problems, it may develop screaming. And screaming, especially if you have a Malacan or an umbrella cockatoo, can rather distress neighbors for a street down, you know. So, and then they don't realize that. They don't think that before they buy the bird. I think for anyone buying a bird, they must realize how time-consuming and, what should I say, it's a dedication. It's a total life commitment. And I think otherwise don't buy a bird because
yes. uh-huh.
it really is. And also educate yourself as much as possible before getting the bird so that you know the proper diet and you know the things that poison it and that aren't good for it. So such as avocado and chocolate, which are deadly poison.
Deadly poison.
Absolute poison, yes.
Yes, certainly something to know. I know that many of the animal protection societies are working to stop the capture, selling, and keeping of exotic animals, but there is the problem of the ones that are already here. And even though we may be working to end the problem, it is urgent to have care for those creatures who are already here, isn't it?
It is urgent. That's exactly it. When they're here, we must look after them. We must. It is our commitment to look after the ones that are here. And I agree with you that they shouldn't be coming in. They shouldn't be importing. They are sometimes imported in tubes, especially budgies, where half of them survive and half don't. And it doesn't really matter to the people who are importing because they're so cheap.
Really?
That is, you know, so sad.
Oh, it's sad. Terrible. But if some people are willing to be good to companions of birds, that they can do a service for them by taking them in. And I certainly think that going to the sanctuary would be the way to do it, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would. Mm-hmm. And it also is quite unbelievable how many wonderful bird owners I see on a daily basis. Absolute, you know, it really, you know, gladdens my heart to see how many actually really, really love their birds.
Oh, that's great to hear. Now, I know you have some interesting quotes from some of the birds that you enjoy. Maybe you could give us a little bit of fun with those, could you?
Okay, I'll go first to a boarder called Charlie. He's an Amazon. And Amazon birds are usually quite clownish. They like being on show. They would love being on a radio program. And Charlie one night would not go to bed. He was not going to go to bed for me or anyone, nothing I could do. So I bribed him, I cajoled him, I did everything I could. In the end, my patience was absolutely worn to nothing. And I said, Charlie, enough now. It's time. You've got to go to bed. And he said, what's the matter? What's your problem? So I couldn't do anything. I was rolling about on the floor laughing. I hadn't heard this bird say that before. What's your problem? And it was so funny. And my African grey, she's allowed to go for a walk on the floor sometimes. And this was one day when she'd done her roly-poly turning upside down, and I hadn't done what she thought I was supposed to do. So she got down on the floor, walked towards the front door, and as birds can turn their head right around, looked at me and said, I'm going, I'm going, I'm going, I'm going. So I said, okay, you want to leave, you can open the front door then. So there are some really funny stories. I'm entertained all the time with absolute funny chatter, you know, the way they put sentences together.
They have a sense of humor.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Wonderful. Now, I know that, Virginia, you have a dream, and I'd like you to tell our listening audience about that.
I do have a dream. My vision for the future is to build or find a beautiful space for a healing spa environment for birds. And there they'll be able to enjoy a sense of freedom and fun while being supervised professionally and with lots and lots of love. There will be organic fruits and vegetables always available and whatever pellets and or seeds they need recommended by their veterinarian. They'll have the opportunity to play games with people or with their toys, which will be supplied by me. For this dream, I need a sponsor and financial assistance.
Oh, that sounds like a wonderful dream.
It is a dream. I've had it for years, and I'll still go for it.
I hope it does come to maturity.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being with us, Virginia.
Thank you very
much.
It's certainly
been a pleasure having you here. You have been listening to an interview with Virginia Phillips, a bird healer who resides in Richmond. Now, if you would like to contact Virginia, I can give you a telephone number and a website. The telephone number is 604-448-1572, 448-1572. And her website, birdtlc, all one word, at yahoo.com, birdtlc at yahoo, that's yahoo.com.
Thanks very much. Thank you very much, ladies. And as an addendum to that, Carl has a little item that we...
Yes, one of the things that everybody can do to save the birds is to take care of your lawn by not using pesticides. and fungicides. They poison your earthworms. They do all kinds of horrible things. And if you're not seeing any birds on your lawns, you should ask yourself why and what you've been spraying on your lawn. Contrary to what these lawn care companies would like people to believe, these weed killers, herbicides, and pesticides, they're not magic bullets. They are broad-spectrum biocides, and by their very nature can harm organisms other than the targeted species. This includes the people who put them on there, and the homeowners, their families, neighbors, pets, birds. Well, we heard all about the birds today, and all other forms of life. The pesticide industry downplays this by claiming their chemicals are heavily diluted, but don't mention that toxins are still extremely dangerous in small amounts. Some pesticides remain active for years after the application. DDT, even though banned many years ago, continues to show up in higher rates in women's breast milk. For the price of green lawns, and yes, there's a movement that we don't have to have those. For the price of green lawns, children are being poisoned. Cats and dogs, through their porous pores, absorb the chemicals from pesticides sprayed on lawns. And this is amazing thing, is that robins will not visit a lawn where the earthworms have been destroyed by poisons. And that is one of the many reasons why we should look at the labels. Weed and feed is not something that we recommend for your lawn. Over to John.
Thanks, Carl. And, of course, all those things have been approved on the backs of animals, as we know. And speaking of that, doctors, our favorite doctors, are suing Merck over Vioxx animal tests. In a lawsuit filed this week, the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, based in Washington, D.C., alleges that Merck and Company wrongfully relied on tests showing Vioxx was safe in animals while ignoring the mounting evidence that the drug is dangerous to humans. Vioxx was a best-selling painkiller, and it was pulled off the market last fall after the approved clinical trials showed cardiac risk to humans. And this is believed to be the first time a U.S. pharmaceutical company has been sued specifically for relying on animal tests. In a moment, we're going to be talking to Mr. Dan Kinburn, who's an associate general counsel for PCRM. We'll be right back. Thank you.
Thank you. This is Jenna Hunt, and I'm with Vancouver Co-op 102.7 FM, and I'm pleased to introduce Dan Kinborn, who's with the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. Thank you, Dan, for taking my call.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I hear this is the very first time that Merck, a U.S. pharmaceutical company, has been sued for relying on animal tests.
That's correct. We felt that that was an important part of the Vioxx story that people didn't understand, that this was not just a problem of a pharmaceutical company allowing greed to get in the way of making good decisions over pharmaceuticals it was selling, but that specifically what Merck did was, as they were in the early stages of selling Vioxx, they did a human study, a very large, well-run human study, and people taking Vioxx started getting sick a lot faster than the group that was taking the drug that Vioxx was being compared to. And so Merck looked at that when that study was over and realized they had to explain why all the Vioxx patients, well, not all the Vioxx patients, but why so many of the Vioxx patients were getting having heart attacks and strokes and other kinds of cardiovascular problems. And in trying to explain that, instead of saying, well, we have this human data, we have to proceed with further human studies to understand what it means, they instead turned to a study of African green monkeys. And they said, well, in African green monkeys, Vioxx acts like aspirin does, that is, it's heart protective. And so we can continue to sell Vioxx to all these millions of people because in African green monkeys, Vioxx is good for your heart. Now, of course, Vioxx was not good for your heart, and African green monkeys are not people. And we think that's an important part of the story that that the public needs to understand.
So it must have been reassuring to have Dr. Pippin's evidence along with what, you know, the work that you had previous.
Yes, well, Dr. Pippin's expertise is very critical here because he's a cardiologist and he understands the mechanism whereby Vioxx causes clotting in humans. And he also understands the important genetic differences between mice and rats and monkeys and people. And what's happened is over the years, pharmaceutical companies have come to rely so heavily on animal testing, even though they know that there are such large genetic differences between the species that a, you know, how a drug acts in a rat versus a mice versus a primate versus a human is just unpredictable and unreliable. So the industry is using unreliable data, and it's doing so basically because it's just the way it's always been done.
Yes, and it's interesting. You'd think that Merck would be well aware of the differences between animals and humans.
Well, of course they are. And of course they recognize that whenever they rely on animal testing, they don't know what it means. They know that, you know, that sometimes there'll be an overlap between the way one species reacts and the way a human reacts, but then sometimes it won't. And there's been a long history of drugs that were put on the market after all the animal testing had been done, and the pharmaceutical companies would say these drugs are safe, and then people would start taking them, and they'd start getting sick, and the drugs would be pulled off the market. So people are being hurt all the time by this improper reliance on unreliable animal testing.
You'd think with all the mounting evidence that there wouldn't be, that the FDA wouldn't want to rely on animal testing.
Well, the problem is, and this is one of the issues we're raising in our lawsuit, that there are promising alternatives to animal testing. For example, there's this concept called microdosing, where you put these very, very tiny amounts of the drug into people, and you study, you know, and you they can be traced within the body, and there are computer models that can be used, and a variety of other techniques that are going to ultimately replace animal testing. But what's happened is the pharmaceutical industry is so used to doing it this old-fashioned way that they haven't been putting the resources that they should be into developing these alternatives that are going to be both ethically better, because they won't be cruel to animals, and which will be more reliable and more based on science.
Yes, and are you going to be having Alice Raisin, or is that pronounced for the Merck?
Oh, Alice Raisin. Yeah, well, she was the one who admitted that Merck had ultimately, you know, that when after Merck got the results of this large human study, that Merck made the decision to continue marketing the drug based solely on animal data. So if there's any question, if Merck tries to pull away from that, we would, of course, call Ms. Raisin to the stand and have her testify. As you may know, there's a trial currently going on in Texas, which is the first of the Vioxx trials. And the plaintiff's attorney there has called many Merck scientists to the stand, and they have had a hard time explaining the decisions they made and the way in which they marketed this dangerous drug.
It almost sounds like Merck was desperate to get it approved, even if all the evidence was showing it was unsafe, that they had invested too much in it to back down.
Well, I think that they recognized how much money there is in these kind of pain relievers, because as our populations get older, and as people, as the older population gets more arthritis and gets more of the other kind of aches and pains that require pain medication over long periods of time, there's a great need for and a huge market for pain relievers that don't cause the stomach problems that aspirin do.
Yeah.
And so they recognized that there was a huge amount of money to be made, and of course, you know, they were very successful in marketing this drug widely. And I think at one point there may have been as many as 20 million people taking this drug. So they knew there was an enormous amount of money at stake. And our position is that when you have human data that shows that the drug may be dangerous, it is irresponsible to rely on animal data to explain away this observed effect in human beings.
Yes. And how is Nancy Tufford's health now?
Well, she has suffered what we call heart failure. That is, her heart muscle does not pump the way it did before she took Vioxx. And so this was she's now 67 years old, and before she took Vioxx, she was very active, went to the gym all the time, had, a million activities, and she has been severely weakened by this. So she can, she's doing about half as much, I would say, of what she used to do, and instead of having this very active, healthy retirement, she is instead going to be somewhat of an invalid through her retirement, and this will affect her throughout the rest of her life, and it may shorten it.
Well, she's very courageous for representing, the damages that it's done to many, many other people as well.
Well, we were very lucky to have her. A lot of people are just interested in recovering money from Merck, and we are suing for money from Merck in this case, but for us, the important thing is to get the message out that reliance on animal testing is not a good thing, that it causes the pharmaceutical industry to make bad decisions, and that there has to be alternatives developed so that animal testing can be phased out over time and replaced with more scientific methods.
Yes, and I think with the suggestions you gave them, there are methods being developed.
Absolutely, and they are detailed in the complaint, which is available on our website at www.pcrm.org.
Here's a question from John Pranger.
Yes, hi, Dr. or Mr. Kinburn. In the past, pharmaceutical companies have used animal experiments as an alibi when they get into court, and I mean, the evidence is that within a year, they already knew. They marketed for another 4 years. They made $25 billion off it. Shouldn't that be a criminal trial, really? Because they've injured people, bodily injured people, and they knew what they were doing.
Well, I think, obviously, a criminal trial would have to be brought by the government. And I think that, what you've seen with respect to the way the FDIC the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, has not been tough on pharmaceutical industries in the way that it should. And so the government has really, I think, let the American consumer down here. And we can't rely on the government to do anything about this. So that's why these kind of private lawsuits have to be brought, because the FDA is not regulating this the way they should. The FDA should be leading the fight to reduce the animal testing and certainly to not let a pharmaceutical company which has human data showing human harm allow that to be just pushed aside by reference to some animal studies.
Yeah. When I'd forgotten my train of thought, but it should be the FDA that needs reforming, isn't it? Because they are the ones who have been approving these things on a regular basis, and they've been doing it for years and years and years.
Well, obviously, the problem with reforming the Food and Drug Administration is that the pharmaceutical industry is a huge lobbyist and spends enormous sums in the United States in getting politicians elected who support the pharmaceutical industry. And so what happens is the Food and Drug Administration is simply not as tough as they should be on industry, and that's just, I think, a reality that's inherent in the way the system works. And so because the government is not protecting people, we need to get the word out through radio programs like yours so that people can at least try to protect themselves, try to understand what these risks are, and ask their doctors about them, and perhaps stay away from medications that are newly on the market and that may not be safe. Because the one of the things about Vioxx was, it really wasn't that big an improvement over the other drugs that were already on the market. And so, you know, a lot of people just thought it was new and therefore it was the best thing and probably tried it out without, of course, ever realizing the risk they were taking. And, you know, but it's a difficult situation because you need the patient, there's the patient's role, and then there's the doctor's role, and then, of course, there's a pharmaceutical industry which is selling the doctors on the notion that this new medication is the best the best thing out there, and that they should be moving all their patients from long-established medications whose safety has been proven by use in the public to this newer, supposedly better medication. And the pharmaceutical industry spends billions of dollars every year trying to push doctors to use the newer, more expensive medications, and that exposes the public to additional risk.
So the doctors today are being educated by detail men and salesmen for the pharmaceutical companies rather than from the journals and better sources, scientific sources.
Yeah, that's the unfortunate truth, and that's really what's coming out in this first Merck trial and what will come out as these cases roll through the courts. I think there's going to be the public's going to have a much better understanding as this process goes forward of how the pharmaceutical industries sort of do this tap dance for doctors, and they wine them and dine them and send them on trips and give them all these perks. And, and of course a doctor is running around all day trying to see patients and has only so much time to devote to learning about new advances in medicine, including new pharmaceuticals. And they are often romanced by the pharmaceutical industry into trying new things because, in theory, this has all been, the Food and Drug Administration has done what it needs to do to say this is safe. And so the doctor thinks, well, it's, the regulators think it's safe, I can prescribe it. Well, that's not always the safest thing to do. And I think that the Vioxx is a great evidence that the system doesn't work very well.
And all the diseases that these are supposed to be treating, PCRM's website lets us know that those are all preventable diseases in the first place.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, what we, you know, our other advocacy mission, aside from use of animals and research, is for better nutrition, and we promote a plant-based diet. And, you know, we just saw the other day this new study that showed that men with early stages of prostate cancer do much, much better and often don't go on to develop serious prostate cancer that needs treating if they stay on a low-fat vegan diet. And so that's what PCRM is trying to do, is to first try to get people to eat a better diet so that they stay healthy, and then also work so that if they do have to take medication, the medication they take has been properly tested and they know that it's safe and effective.
Yes. And can I ask you, too, how long have you been working with PCRM?
I've been working here for 2 years. I came here after 25 years of practice doing corporate litigation for big companies, and I just felt the time had come to give something back and to work on something that was more important than making money. And so I took a huge cut in pay and came here to do what I can to help this great cause.
They're very lucky to have you.
That's very nice of you to say.
Do you think there'd be any use having people like PETA or, you know, maybe something more mainstream talking about the actual inhumane aspect of the case?
Well, a lot of organizations are talking about this. I mean, certainly PETA has programs to do, you know, that along these same lines. I think everyone in the animal protection community, you know, understands that that there needs to be a move away from animal testing, that it is simply just old-fashioned and unreliable. And so there are many organizations that are working using their own methods and their own, campaigns to get this word out, because I think people just assume that animal testing is absolutely necessary and it's the only way drugs can be approved, and right now that's true, but it's true because the regulations require that the animal testing be done. If the regulations didn't require it, if the FDA would accept any kind of sound scientific data to help establish that a drug was safe and effective, then the pharmaceutical companies could start to could use different methods of gaining data that are both better from an ethical standpoint and more effective scientifically. But what the regulations do is it forces people to use this old-fashioned method, which just simply cannot be relied upon.
Well, it sounds like this could be a groundbreaking case.
Well, we certainly hope so, and we know that it is the first suit of its type in the country, and we hope ultimately that a jury will say that Merck acted irresponsibly in relying upon animal testing and will compensate Nancy Tufford fairly for the losses she suffered as a result of the improper conduct of Merck.
Yes. Well, thank you for your time, and I'm just going to give our listeners the website again. It's pcrm.org, and I'm speaking with Dan Kinborn from the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, who's a lawyer taking the Merck case against Merck for the improper use of animal testing. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And you're listening to Animal Voices on 102.7 FM here in Vancouver. We're going to take a little break, and then Carl is going to entertain us with some serious thoughts. Thank you.
from Vancouver Co-op. The Sunshine Coast residents and conservationists are cheering yesterday because BC Environmental Appeal Board decision denied water rights that would have supplied a luxury home development that includes several PNE prize homes. Water, the Sierra Legal Defense Fund, successfully argued that the development's water needs could pose unacceptable risks to the local environment, and further study is required. As demand for the water grows, the decision is likely an indication of the type of water disputes that will become increasingly common in BC. Municipalities and the provincial government cannot continue to ignore environmental concerns and make decisions on the false assumption that there is an endless supply of water, stated Randy Christensen, a lawyer with Sierra Legal Defense Fund, who argued on behalf of the local residents. And anyway, we are pleased the Environmental Appeal Board rejected this reckless approach. If the water was taken from the lake, it would have reduced the source of water for local residents, and also it would have endangered the Sakinaw Sockeye population, which lives in the lake. And I'm sorry I couldn't take a call. I believe the Sierra Legal Defense Fund was phoning me, but I'll get back to you later. Thank you.
Yes, and Jen, I'd like to follow up on what you were speaking about, Vioxx and the PCRM lawsuit there on animal testing. And one of the basic conditions here about that one needs to recognize, and I'm sure it'll be part of the lawsuit, is that when you're relying on animal research, it cannot work for many reasons. And one of them is that every species of animal is totally different biomedical, biochemical, and biomechanical entity. So what applies to one species does not necessarily apply to another. Animals are not only different, but they also react differently to different drugs, vaccines, and chemical substances. And so why are we continuing to do this? And I certainly hope that this lawsuit will be very successful. The Animal Defense and Vivisection Society, you can reach them. You can read many of the articles, which will confirm many of the what you'd like to know. It's animalvoices.org/ADAV. And the ADAV stands for Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection Society. Well, if I still have a few minutes left here, I'd like to comment on an article that appeared in this week's Maclean's magazine. Yes, and it was an article, in fact, I considered it a fair article about the PETA protests in Halifax, where PETA was protesting that fishing is inhumane and eating fish is unhealthy. Well, you can very well imagine, as was also pointed out in this article in Maclean's, that Maritime Fishermen's Union were not too pleased about that, and they called the protest a publicity stunt, and that they also felt if we're not going to eat fish, what else is there to eat? But John's just laughing here because we know we've got a bowl of blueberries here, and we're asking everybody this time to go out and get the free blackberries that are everywhere, and that's such good food. It gives you so many minerals. Well, anyway, one has to look at, I'd like to just look at the two questions here. One is that fish, the fish, that it's fishing is inhumane. Well, we have to consider the wonderful aspects of this species. They navigate the oceans, can find their way back within, and having traveled for thousands of miles. And these fishes are often territorial, and they frequently recognize dangers. We know that. They know what a hook. They recognize it. They see, smell. They have eyes. They procreate. Yet, there seems to be an illusion that fish have no feelings. Despite the magic of these creatures, humans have polluted the oceans with mercury, raw sewage, bunker oils, hormones, and chemicals. Now, in the Vancouver Sun, we had a recent research from the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, and it said how grizzly bears have been contaminated here in BC, and they're feeding off the fish. So would humans be immune from all these poisons if they continue to eat fish? And my last sentence here, we only have a few seconds left, is I certainly feel that fish have feelings, and the oceans need to recover from this fishing frenzy that has put all sea life at risk.
All sea life indeed. Now, if you really want really good blueberries, they're at the East End Food Co-op, which is a Vancouver's only consumer-owned grocery store, and they're really sweet. I've had blueberries purchased from elsewhere, and they were sour, but the ones here are unsprayed and basically organic, and they're just a lovely, lovely taste. Well, that's the end of our program. Thanks for listening to Animal Voices. Our website, once again, is animalvoices.org. Our email is animalvoices_radio@yahoo.ca. We'll talk to you next week.